year to date, the defining macro trend feels like going from 6 rate cuts to 2 rate cuts this year and pushing the first rate cut from May to, I think now it's in September, I think.
And so joining us now on Speak Up with Anthony Scaramucci, Travis Kling. He's the Chief Investment Officer of Ikigai Asset Management. I think Travis is very proud of me for pronouncing that right, or almost right, given my Long Island upbringing and accent. But welcome to the show, sir. I'm a huge fan of yours, and I appreciate your journey. So let's start with that. You're a Wall Streeter, okay? You were a traditional finance person. Explain your Ikigai. Explain how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Yeah, so I went in a pretty straight direction the first 10 years out of college, which was energy investing, mostly oil and gas, some power and alternatives, and did a couple years of oil and gas M&A out of college, went to work for a hedge fund called Magnetar Capital in Chicago, doing long-short energy equities and non-control private equity and debt. Was there for 4.5 years and then went to Point 72 and was running an energy and materials equities portfolio there. So not a tech guy by background, not a tech investor by background, not somebody. I think, as you know, people come to crypto from various directions, and there's some paths that are more well-worn than others. A lot of guys come from a more of a tech kind of background. I did not. I fell down the proverbial crypto rabbit hole the summer of 2017 and convinced myself that all this stuff was going to be a big deal, and left traditional to pursue crypto investing full time. Decided to start my own investment firm in early 2018. And if you Google Ikigai, you'll see this Venn diagram. Maybe you've seen what you're good at, what you like to do, what the world needs, and what you deserve to be paid for. And if you find those four things, then you find your Ikigai. And for me, I had a career in traditional hedge fund investing, and I liked doing it. I was pretty reasonably good at it, made a fine living doing it. But, you know, to be honest with you, the world doesn't need another hedge fund manager. And if the world doesn't get another hedge fund manager, the world's going to be just fine. But, you know, I felt like at the time, and still do feel like, the world needs this technology, and this technology has the potential to make the world a better place in various different ways. Potential, I think that's an important word, and maybe we can dive more into that. But and I felt like if I could just kind of take my skill set and my background, because there's a lot of things I'm not very good at, and I had a career in, you know, investing basically, and if I could try and kind of take that skill set and that experience and apply it towards, you know, maybe helping bring this technology to fulfill its potential to make the world a better place, then you know, that's like my fourth circle of Ikigai.
All right. Well, the word is a phenomenal word, right? And before we got started, you said it was an 1,100-year-old ancient Japanese word. And it's the intersection of all those great things that you're discussing. And that's, every life should be that purposeful. And I can just tell by the way you're dressed, okay, you've transformed from traditional finance, which is in this window box on this wonderful broadcast show, to finance or decentralized finance. And you had to have had a eureka moment, sir. So tell us the eureka moment. And if the follow-up question is going to be, people that look like me, dress like this, are not in a eureka moment. I just got off a television set where I had three skeptics. I was in a almost semicircular firing squad where three skeptics were shooting at me. So what was your eureka moment, and why do very, very smart people that we both know, they can't seem to get there?
Well, in some ways, it's easy for me to have empathy for that, because it's an incredibly strange thing. You know, and I think I'll first start off by saying, let's put Bitcoin in a separate category than any other crypto asset. I did not think about that at the time in the summer of 2017. But I'd say probably by 2019, my view developed that really you should think of Bitcoin completely different than the rest of these things. And I think that's only, that gap is only furthered since then. And Bitcoin doesn't have any other competitors really in crypto. It kind of competes with the dollar. It kind of competes with treasuries. We can talk about that more if you want to, but it's really in a class by itself. But going back to 2017, when I was kind of falling down the crypto rabbit hole, I finally read the Bitcoin white paper in May of 2017. And it's 9 pages long. You know that. It doesn't take long to read. And I had no idea what it was about because I didn't know anything about computer science. I didn't know anything about cryptography. So I did have to start at just ground zero at the very, very beginning. And I always talk about it in just sheer numbers of hours. Like, I think you have to do, I had to do 300 hours of self-study before I really got to the point where I was ready to kind of bet my career on this direction. But the first 50 hours are so elementary that, you know, I mean, it's just Wikipedia pages. It's real basic stuff. And I think as I went from 50 hours to 100 hours to 200 to 300, I just kept coming across revolutionary concept after revolutionary concept. And in aggregate, after about 300 years, I kind of came to the conclusion that it seemed quite unlikely to me that the world was going to look at all of this and say, none of this is important. None of this matters. I didn't know which asset was going to make it. I didn't have developed views on the direction of the ecosystem, but just the concept of blockchains and decentralization and the different use cases, it seemed like quite unlikely that the world was just going to say none of this matters at all. And then the other thing is that it triggered this feeling in me that I had only had one other time in my life. Like I said, I'm not a tech investor, so I wasn't used to seeing a new business idea. I wasn't a venture investor. Seeing an early stage business idea saying, wow, that is a phenomenal idea. I can see how big it could be. I did not have career experience doing that. But what I did do is when I was living in Chicago, I took an Uber very early before like any of my friends had ever heard about it. I randomly read this article. Chicago was the second city after San Francisco to get Uber. I think it was like early 2012. And I got the app. It was black car only, picked me up from my apartment, took me downtown, dropped me off on the sidewalk, drove away. And I remember standing on that sidewalk and going, that's going to change everything. And I just had this incredible conviction. And as the years went on and you saw what Uber did, I used to joke around. I should have just quit my job the day I took that first Uber, gone to work at Uber, pay me in shares. And that would have worked out well for me. So the second time in my life that I felt that way was when I really jumped into crypto.
All right. Well, I'm hoping this second time is good for you and me, because I had Travis in my office, the founder of Uber. The company had a $50 million valuation at the time. He was looking for $500,000. And I said, wait, let me just get this right. There's going to be an unknown guy in an unknown black car that's going to be driving my daughter around the streets of New York. And he said, yes, that's correct. I said, get the hell out of my office. So I'll let you know how smart I am. And so I was probably a retirement decision. Maybe the good Lord didn't want me to retire at that moment, because had I given him that money, you and I probably wouldn't be talking, Travis. And then life wouldn't be good, Travis. Life wouldn't be as good as it is now, right?
Yeah.
I keep telling myself that, but that was a big miss for me. One miss, regrettably, that I did not miss, which was a direct bullseye for me, was FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried. Both of us have a Sam Bankman-Fried story. Tell me your story, if you don't mind.
Yeah, we were the 18th largest creditor in the FTX bankruptcy. We had a $65 million claim. It was the large majority of my hedge fund's assets. And we had been doing we have a pretty active trading strategy. And part of that, the nature of the strategy was such that we keep a lot of assets on exchange a meaningful amount of time. And I did not have a firsthand relationship with Sam. I'd never met him before. But I had just let let the risk management slip. I never in my wildest dreams could have imagined that what would have happened and got caught up in it. It was, you know, brutal. It was undoubtedly the most challenging career experience in my life. Definitely one of the most challenging life experiences ever, for sure. And in the months afterwards, it wasn't entirely sure that we were going to be able to continue operating Ikigai. And I think, as you know, largely because the prices of crypto went up a lot and because Anthropic ended up being a great investment, the bankruptcy for FTX just has turned out much better than what people were assuming. in the initial weeks and months after the bankruptcy. So we sold our claim. It's not public what we sold it for. We sold the claim at the end of November for a price that we were very happy with, and took those proceeds and you know, we're now, you know, been back in the market since then. And it was an incredibly painful experience and a bit of a, you know, metaphorical near death experience, but we made it out the other side of this thing. So,
yeah, listen, he hurt me. I mean, I allowed him to buy 30% of my business. I guess the good fortune, due to my caution, he didn't buy more than that, but he certainly hurt me, hurt our reputations. I think we're on the other side of it now because the, you know, the Department of Justice has already rendered who they thought the guilty parties were, thank God. But it was very, very painful. But I think important to the story, which I want you to talk about, Travis, is your stick-to-itness, your persistence. You know, you're snagged in this. The markets are roiling. Your Bitcoin assets or other assets down anywhere from 50 to 80%. You stay with it. You make the decision to sell your claim. You get out and reinvest in November. And of course, these assets have done very well since November of 2023. So tell us about your stick-to-itness as an investor, the persistence that you have.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm 39 years old, so that makes me I am a crypto boomer, a proper crypto boomer. And I think you just have a few laps around the track and you go through difficult periods of time. And I think in those instances, I get very one foot in front of the other, one day at a time. And I don't know if that's the right way or the wrong way to do it. It's how I have experienced difficult periods in my time of life previously. And, you know, in a fund situation, and my business partner and I were the largest investors. We're the largest LPs in the fund. So there nobody was sort of hurt more financially than we were by this mistake that I made. And there's a fiduciary duty concept here where you're in the midst of this thing. And I've been a fiduciary for a long time. And this just means that you just put the investors, they just go front and center every day in all ways, always. And you know, I tried to keep that with my business partner and I, and a lot of credit goes to him as well too. We tried to keep that at the forefront. And then you just, we had a lot of encouragement from our LPs, a lot, a surprising amount given the magnitude of the mistake that was made. And that was also very heartwarming and encouraging. So that was helpful. I wanted, before we get off Sam, I wanted to ask you one question. How did you feel about his sentence? It's a deep question.
So I mean, it is a deep question. I'm going to answer cursorily. The overwhelming feeling I've had about Sam is sadness. I think I had some anger when I was facing the music from the media and I was getting excoriated in the media and people were writing the obituary of me financially, at least my financial obituary and Skybridge's financial obituary. And so I was angry in the beginning, I'm not going to lie, but today I feel sadness when I see a troubled young man like that. And I would encourage you, not that it'll make you feel better about the situation, but just from a human point of view, I have five children. When I read Sam's testimony that he was about to give to the Congress as a dad, listening to a young man who's somebody's son talk about their trouble and the overwhelming depression that he had. And I think he was heavily medicated, by the way, which is a whole other topic that will probably come out. Sadness. Could he have deserved more or less? I honestly don't know. I don't think a 35-year sentence is fair in a situation like that, given the circumstances, given what you just described in terms of the harm that was done, was lessened by the markets, thank God. But I feel sad about the situation. I don't feel really, it's not a murder. And now the person that murdered somebody is sentenced. This is a misguided person that hurt people financially. And so he'll serve his time. He'll lose a very large portion of his adult life. And obviously when he comes back from that, it's anybody's guess what happens to him. But I don't see this as a Michael Milken situation, by the way, where I think Michael was unfairly penalized back in the 80s. This is my opinion, but he's worked the last 30 years to reclaim his good reputation. You know, how did you feel about the sentence?
You know, I would have, if you told me that part of his parole was that he could never manage a company again of any kind, I'd feel way better about the situation. Mm-hmm. I think I was hoping for a sentence, and I think it's kind of on the, if you assume that he does 80% of 25 years.
By federal statute, he has to, unless somebody commutes him. He has to have a president commute the sentence, but he has to serve.
Yeah, I saw when I was researching this, I saw that I think it was Jeff Skilling that worked through the appeals court for like three years and then ended up getting, I think he got some plea down stuff, and then he ended up only doing about half of what his sentence was.
Okay.
And so in my head, 20 years feels like plenty, especially if you told me that he basically can't ever get back into crypto again. Because one of the things that I've done a lot of soul searching, as you can imagine, in the wake of FTX, and my, to the extent I have a public voice in this space, my public voice changed some. And part of it was this realization of the magnitude of the attack vector of bad actors that we have in crypto.
Yeah.
How damaging they have been. And that if you're being honest with ourselves, we're not doing a good job of keeping bad actors from rising to places of enormous power and influence.
Yes.
Incredible, right? And so part of this is like, and I feel the exact same way with Changpeng Zhao, identical same way, where it's just, where if you told me that he just doesn't get to be in crypto anymore, I would feel so much better about that overall situation.
Right.
And I feel the same way for Sam. And I don't know, maybe 20 years is enough that he's going to get out and he's going to be 50 years old. And, you know, maybe crypto has moved on enough, or he's not in the mood or whatever. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I mean, you're bringing up a lot of interesting points. And so I'm in the category that the SEC has hurt the industry and also helped the industry. And so it's hurt the industry because it's not providing any clarity. It's not providing any regulatory guidelines, and the result of which these lawsuits and this lawsuits and regulation by enforcement, obviously not helping anybody, makes them look bad. And they've lost a ton of court cases, and they've even been shamed in the court for lying on some of their complaints that they've written to the courts. But they have helped in a weird way, Travis, and just bear with me for a second. They should have approved a Bitcoin ETF, a cash ETF or a spot ETF in the first quarter of 2022. For political reasons, they elected not to. And of course, they lost the court case because they needed to, pursuant to administrative law. But them not passing that or not approving it opened the door for the slide in crypto and the exposure of Sam, Three Arrows, Celsius, I could name 5 or 10 companies, right. Terra Luna, all of which imploded as a result of the fact that we didn't get the ETF in the first quarter of 2022. Mm. We could still be living in a Sam Bankman-Fried world.
Yeah.
And that world would have led to an even bigger, more cataclysmic explosion. But I just think we need to cut it out in the United States if we want to maintain our financial services leadership. We just got to regulate it and regulate it fairly and properly. Let's go to the macro for a sec.
I got to put you on the spot because we're talking about politics for a second. Who do you think is going to win the election, and what is your confidence level?
Well,
you cannot answer that too.
I'm going to answer the problem.
When I'm on a podcast with a guy like you, I got to ask, right?
Yeah, like, Travis, the viewers and listeners are going to hate me for this because I think we have a lot of right-leaning listeners on Wealthion, and I'm a right-leaning person. I've been a right-leaning person my whole life. I fit in with the Dana Whites and the Joe Rogans and so forth. Those guys are guys that I respect and admire, but I don't fit in with Donald Trump. I work for Donald Trump, and I understand the danger of him. So I get why people are supporting him, though. We've got a big crisis at the border. We have this whole woke culture war. We've got the crime in this beautiful city that I'm sitting in, the urban crime has people upset. So I understand why people are not going to vote for Joe Biden, at least a lot of the people that I'm friends with and intellectually in sync with. I just understand the danger of Donald Trump. But the answer to your question is, who do I think is going to win the election, not who am I going to vote for? And I think Biden wins the election handily because he's going to have way more money than Trump when push comes to shove. And he'll have 5 or 6 field offices in the swing states relative to 1 or 2 offices for Donald Trump. And that's going to be the game changer, because I submit to everybody listening, these guys have 50 years of being brands in America. This is not the Barack Obama introduction tour that 2008 was. Everybody knows who these two entities are, and everybody has an opinion. And so this is going to be a get out the vote exercise as opposed to anything else. And I think the president will have way more apparatus to do that. And I don't think it'll be bad for crypto because, he'll no longer be beholden to Elizabeth Warren. He has a lot of pressure on him right now from the likes of people like myself and the Ron Conways of the world and the Brian Armstrongs, who are actually supporting him, but telling him that this is wrong what you're doing to the world of crypto. So we'll see. Who do you think is going to win the election? Now that we're on the election,
I have no idea. I don't feel like I have an informed view at all. I really don't.
All right. So what about macroeconomics? You have a view on that. You're really good at that. So what do you think's going on there? Where do you think the Fed is?
Year to date, the defining macro trend feels like going from 6 rate cuts to 2 rate cuts this year and pushing the first rate cut from May to, I think now it's in September, I think. Maybe October. And risk assets have been able to hang in pretty well through that. I think NASDAQ's up 5% this year. Crypto's obviously done well this year. The market has gotten a little skittish just over the last, risk assets in general have gotten a little skittish over the last, I guess it's been a week or a week and a half now since that CPI print came out. It took another cut out of the curve off that print. Push the date back some of the first cut off that print. Now people are thinking, or what happens to, tech stocks and in turn crypto, if we go from 2 rate cuts this year to 0 rate cuts this year, is there a chance that they're going to have to hike rates again? And that just seems to be kind of front and center. And then with some sprinkle of, and not to talk about it flippantly, but some kind of World War III risk sprinkled in there as well too, which is, that's obviously a really sad thing, but it does, I think, to a lesser degree have markets skittish, but those are the types of things that can obviously escalate really, really, really quickly in a really scary way. It seems to me like there's an enormous amount of cash sloshing around. Crypto is heavily beholden to global liquidity characteristics, monetary and fiscal policy, M2 money supply, that type of stuff. And I think specifically with Bitcoin, with these ETFs, we have had, there's enough of a structural inflow that has occurred there. And I think there's some more of that to come, just directional, slow, structural inflows. And I, you would know better than me. I'd be curious to hear your views on that. Bitcoin's probably going to trade fine this year, even if risk assets broadly are going from 2 cuts to 0 cuts and getting nervous about maybe a hike instead of a future cut. I do think that would probably, meaningfully curtail how high Bitcoin's price might get this year, as opposed to, if they cut, say, 4 times this year. Like, you would just expect Bitcoin's price to be higher in that scenario. Yeah. But I wouldn't be super worried about the kind of downside in Bitcoin. Yeah.
All right. So I'm the contrarian here, right? And I appreciate the data, but I think that there's something else going on. And I could be completely wrong. The same thing that got the Fed in trouble at the beginning of COVID, which was the incredible induction of money into the economy and the massive fiscal stimulus, which led to this inflation that we have. And just to remind viewers and listeners, we've lost 22% of the dollar's value. The U.S. dollar, in terms of its purchasing power, has gone down 22% in the last 4 years. So it's really putting a strain on lower and middle income people. But the Fed missized the inflation on the way in. They said it was going to be transitory inflation because they thought the supply chain was going to connect more quickly. I think what's happening now is the data is lagging where the actual inflation is. There were good numbers in Europe where I was this week. And I think when you get to the end of the second quarter, when you get to the end of June, you're going to see lots of these numbers better than people expect, which is going to force the Fed to cut rates, which will put less pressure on the debt side of the economy for everybody, not just the congressman, but also the real estate, the mortgage brokers, et cetera.
Sorry, do you mean the data coming in weaker than expected? So then that gives the Fed room to cut? Is that what you meant by that?
Weaker. Meaning more inclination. The economic data is going to suggest that it's time for a cut. Well, so when I say better than expected, I mean data that will allow them to cut. Obviously, it's a weird thing about markets and the economy. Worse data allows them to cut, which gives the market a little bit more flexibility in terms of price appreciation. But again, I could be wrong. It's just these are my feelings about it. Let me go to a topic that I always like asking people. Is there something today that this audience could take advantage of? If you had an idea or there was a spot, you say, you know, listen, this is something I think is going to work over the next 3 to 6 months. Anything right there in the sweet spot of your investment zone?
Well, I got to be careful about this stuff, as you know, from a regulatory perspective, getting on. You know, this is absolutely not financial advice, but I can stick with an easy one. Do you know, if you were just going to guess, finger in the air, what percent of your listeners that are going to watch this own Bitcoin?
Good question. I'm going to say less than half, but I would say more than 25%.
Okay. So then it's very easy for me to give a Bitcoin dollar cost average pitch. And even up here, that's a very fine thing to do. You can Google around for kind of Bitcoin DCA trends. I think there's a website that tracks this thing. But a dollar cost averaging strategy for Bitcoin has just been such a great investment for such a long time through incredible increases in price and stunningly decreases in price. And if you just chug along like that, that has just been so good for you. And if you want to get a little cute with it, you can put on incredibly basic risk management stuff around. There's something called the Mayer multiple. Maybe you're familiar with that, where it's the distance that Bitcoin's price is above or below its 200-day moving average. Incredibly simplistic stuff. And so maybe if you want to get cute, you can like cut the DCA when you're way up above the 200-day. Maybe you want to juice the DCA when you're below the 200-day.
Where is it now? Pursuant to the Mayer multiple, where is it now?
I would probably be slightly like a bit above, but not in a crazy zone. Definitely still in a buy zone for sure. And then I think each person's portfolio allocation about how much, that's a very person by person dependent thing. How old you are, what your family situation is, what your general risk appetite is, what your knowledge of crypto is, just different things like that. But, you know, I think 5% in Bitcoin makes sense for everybody. You know, my mother had 5% of her net worth. She's 71 years old. If you're younger, you want to do more, you can do more. If you want to do 10%, 15%, something like that, and you can DCA into it. And I always try and give just a quick kind of 1 minute pitch on what Bitcoin is. And so Bitcoin is a non-sovereign, hard cap supply, global, immutable, decentralized, digital store of value. That's six adjectives. That's a lot of adjectives, but each one of them is important in its own right. And it is a insurance policy against monetary and fiscal policy irresponsibility from central banks and governments globally. That's what it is. If you are bullish on central bank balance sheet growth, and if you are bullish on M2 money supply growth, and sort of the inverse of that is that you're worried about the diminishment of your purchasing power over a multi-year, multi-decade period of time, Bitcoin is a great financial instrument for that. And I have a higher degree of confidence of that, certainly than anything else in the crypto ecosystem.
Do you have a near term, like what's your year end price target for Bitcoin?
Oh, I try not to do stuff like that. There's a lot of variance around it. You know, if I was going to throw out a number, I would say somewhere probably right above or right below 100K. But that's not a high, I'm not highly confident in that number. There's, and I would say the tail is fatter to the upside. Mm-hmm. I think there are paths where you really pick up steam in these ETFs. And the ETFs are what got us to new all-time highs as quickly as we did. It was an incredibly straightforward mm-hmm. reasoning behind the, you know, Bitcoin was up, I think, 46% in February. Incredibly straightforward why that happened. 17% last month. Incredibly straightforward why that happened. So I don't have like a great, you know, and I think I want to put it back to you about your feeling around ETF inflows. I do not have a great sense of the range of outcomes for the ETF inflows over the rest of this year and the likelihood that it's this amount versus this amount versus this amount. But what I do have a high degree of confidence in is if you told me which one of those they were, I could tighten up my price prediction a lot more, if that makes sense.
All right, makes sense to me. I mean, I appreciate you you clarifying all of this for us. I think, look, that's my number one investment idea. So I'm with you on that. We're going to take some outside questions, Travis. So let's go to our first guy. How is Bitcoin good for America and Americans? And I don't mean why it's good for individuals to get rich. And this could be a macro question here. This is John from Rhode Island.
So what I would say, Bitcoin is good for Americans because it protects your purchasing power. I think I just laid that out. And that's good for everybody on Earth. No matter if you're in developed or developing nation, that's a good thing. What I would say is if you're thinking of it from a, you know, nationalistic perspective, America first perspective, actually stable coins would be, which is not Bitcoin. And so I'm kind of dodging his question, but I tried to answer his question just now, but then broadening it out to crypto, stable coins are unequivocally pro-dollar. This is dollarizing the entire world and getting into places that were unable to be dollarized based on, you know, banking logistics or relation, you know, geopolitical relationship type of stuff. The whole world wants a dollar. Bitcoin is not, if you go somewhere where they're experiencing an extremely unstable home currency, they want digital dollars. They really want Tether on Tron. That is what they want. The numbers support that. And they want that more than Bitcoin. And to the extent that that continues to grow the way it has, this is dollar strengthening, pro-dollar. The dollar gets even more powerful, and then America's influence over the world gets more powerful.
All right. And I think that's the answer. I mean, if you get Bitcoin in the equation, I think, John, I could be overly interpreting the question, but John could also be talking about the dollar supremacy and the need for us to maintain the supremacy in terms of the flexibility it provides our economy. And I think with both Travis and I believe is that the stronger Bitcoin is, the stronger the blockchain digitization will be. And the US dollar will be in a digitalized format. Now, I would make the argument that we could do that in the private sector with things like Circle. And I think we've got to get more transparency on Tether, but I like Tether. I think Tether is way more stable than people give it credit for. But let's go to the next question. What is your take on Dogecoin? This is Freddie from California. Well, let me duck under the table while you're saying
that. So it's a meme coin. It does not have quote unquote fundamental value. We could do a separate podcast on what the concept of fundamental value even means, both in traditional assets and in crypto assets. Bitcoin has value because of its monetary properties. It has, you know, it helps to understand the investment case for Bitcoin to understand monetary history, the history of money, the history of debt, and the history of world reserve currencies. Bitcoin has the properties to be a good money, so it earns a monetary premium. Dogecoin doesn't have that. What the sort of new age answer that resonates with me to a certain degree is that human attention is the new oil. You know, people used to say data is the new oil. Well, sort of the funnel for data is just human attention. And human attention is becoming incredibly valuable. Many of the most valuable tech companies in the world, they are valuable because of the attention, the human attention that they have. And so you would back into this by saying sort of anything that has attention, therefore has value. That would be the pitch. And Dogecoin has a lot of attention, therefore it has value. Now, does that mean, I can't remember what its market cap is right now. It's probably 30 billion or something like that. Now, is that the right number? That's a separate conversation. And I could never feel comfortable recommending somebody invest in Dogecoin. I guess one thing I would say is some people have like 2% of their paycheck that's like, oh, when I go to Vegas, if I lose $2,000 at the craps table, you know, it sucks, but it's not the end of the world. If I win $2,000, oh, I had a fun time. I paid for my trip. It's not going to make me or break me. If you want to take that or half that and go play around in meme coins, like have at it, you know, but just do it eyes wide open.
All right. So you're a very polite, very diplomatic guy. So I would say, Freddie, stay away from Dogecoin. Okay. It's dog shit. And even though it has a $21 billion market cap, it's not something that I would recommend to anybody. But I understand what Travis is saying. If you're a speculator, this is as good as any other thing to speculate on, but I'm not a speculator. And I don't want people to be speculators. Be long-term investors, long-term thinkers. Let's go to the next one. Iran's attack on Israel seems to have triggered a dip in Bitcoin. Do you see a correlation? This is Izzy from Texas. This is also the Andrew Sorkin question. If it's a store of value and it's a quote-unquote inflation hedge, shouldn't it have traded up on this exogenous black swan-like news?
Yeah, I have not thought about it like that. It's an emerging store of value. It doesn't have the characteristics of a gold or a dollar or a treasury. It may have those characteristics one day. It may sort of represent that in a quote-unquote multi-factor cross-asset model one day. But it's not that right now. You shouldn't expect it to trade like that. And it really just didn't dip that much. I mean, it had just ripped 100% in a straight line. And, you know, I don't know, we're like 15% off the top or something like that. So I think trying to tie that, you know, too much is a reach from Andrew Ross Sorkin. And as you and I both know, that's his job, is to kind of poke the bear in that kind of way. So, you know, journalists are going to do what journalists are incentivized to do. There's geopolitical risk to the downside in crypto. I would certainly, if conflict escalates, you know, I want to be crystal clear. People should not expect their Bitcoin to go up in value. That would not be my base case expectation in the near term. It would go down. It would go down by some amount. And there's some situation where all risk assets are trading off really hard. Think back to COVID, beginning of COVID, March of 2020. Traditional markets are under incredible levels of stress. That stress metastasizes over into the crypto market, into the Bitcoin market, and then causes some kind of, in March of 2020, it was BitMEX, which at the time was the most highest volume derivatives exchange for Bitcoin. BitMEX basically broke and greatly exacerbated the price crash. And maybe you could have something like that in a real, you know, kind of black swan type of scenario.
I think it's a great answer. Let's go to the next question. I have a bunch of money that's been held up in a Gemini earn account due to the bankruptcy of their partner Genesis. Can you explain what's going on? This is Steve from South Carolina.
Yeah, so definitely not legal advice. It is my understanding that, again, do not take my word for it, but you can find information about it Googling around or looking on Twitter. It's my understanding that they just reached a settlement between Gemini and Genesis, and the judge, I believe, just approved that portion of that bankruptcy. And I believe EARN customers are going to get almost all of their assets back in kind, over 90%, I believe. But again.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, it looks like it's going the right way, Steve, but these bankruptcies take forever. I think Travis and I's message to you is that you'll likely get 90 cents back on the dollar, but you got to be patient. And of course, in a bankruptcy situation, they dollarize assets. And so Travis knows this, and I know this. If you,
sorry to interrupt. So it's my understanding that specifically in the Genesis bankruptcy, they have now introduced a extremely, in my understanding, rare waterfall concept whereby everybody gets paid back 100 cents on the dollar, dollarized at petition date. And to the extent that there are then assets left over, it starts a waterfall concept back to in-kind investors. If you had Bitcoin and they have your Bitcoin, and then I believe the estimate is that in kind, you're going to get 90%+ back. So if you're not getting 90%+ of Bitcoin at January, I think 19th prices, that you'll actually get the actual BTC back. But again, don't quote me on that, but I think that's how it works. It's very rare on that. And to your point, not the way that the FTX bankruptcy went.
All right, there you go. That's why we got Travis on the show. Let's go to the next one. What do you see coming in the way of government regulation over crypto? This is Alex from Ohio. I'll let you start with that one, Travis.
Well, November is going to make a huge difference. It's going to make a big difference if somehow we get a Republican in the White House. Gary Gensler, I would expect, would not continue as SEC. I would expect you would immediately move into a much more cooperative rule by what's the term when the SEC their rule made rule by exception, is that what they call that?
Rule by enforcement. They're bringing cases. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What I meant was, I think it's my understanding that the expectation is that if you got a more cooperative SEC chair, that there could be a series of no action letters that were issued that would then begin to sort of back into a framework that is constructed by way of no action letters.
Yeah.
And that would be able to front run legislation, which hopefully you would be able to get in that next legislative session, 25-26 kind of deal.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, listen, I'm of the view that Gensler's gone one way or the other.
Okay.
He's had a unsatisfactory time as commissioner. He's trying, if you like Gensler, go to Twitter, because he's out there praising himself and all the things that he's done at the SEC, but it did really just sound like a whining session from Gary Gensler. But then again, if you look like Jiminy Cricket in real life, you'd be taking it out on us as well, Travis. So funny you know.
Okay, again, to put you on the spot, do you have a time period for Gensler stepping down as your base case?
I think he steps down right after the election. I think it's too embarrassing for him to step down before the election. It would help Joe Biden if he did, but Joe Biden's got too much pressure on him from this this woman called Elizabeth Warren, who I'm spending money, time, and energy trying to defeat in Massachusetts. She's the scourge of the industry and a longtime regressive. She's against the poor and the middle class, and she's a servant of special interests that literally pay her to stay in Congress. So anyway, let's keep going. You and I have made the show more political than I thought. Let's keep going. We got one more question. This is our last question. Do you expect another major dip this year in crypto prices, or was this just a correction? This is Ashley from New Jersey. What do you think, Travis?
So we have not had a 25% correction since Sam collapsed FTX. And this is in Bitcoin price, which I am not entirely sure Bitcoin's ever gone that long. I think it actually is the longest period that Bitcoin's gone without a 25% correction. And that in and of itself is interesting. So the way I'll try and specify the question is sort of, what do I think the likelihood is that Bitcoin has a down 50% move from the top? So let's define it as that this year. And that feels like a 30 to 40% probability is where I'd put that, a down 50% move. And I can imagine the scenarios where that would happen. Like, for example, if you told me that inflation's running hot, the curve goes from two cuts to zero cuts, while we get an increase, or maybe because we get an increase in conflict risk abroad, you know, if you got that, then the likelihood we do it down 50% off the top, that would increase my likelihood. And then, you know, what's the likelihood that we get only a 25% or maybe let's say a 25 to 50% dip? That feels like pretty likely to me. You know, maybe I'd put that at a 50% probability or something like that.
I think it's well said. You know, Ashley, expect big corrections. You know, we're sitting here when the show is broadcasting at 63,000, but I don't have that in my head as my figure for Bitcoin in terms of its permanency. Both Travis and I know that this is an early adopting technology. It's got to go through a billion wallets before I think it stabilizes from a volatility perspective. So, but it's like I said to Anthony Pompliano, Travis, you got to act like you're dead when you own Bitcoin. You know, dead people don't look at their accounts. And it turns out that the dead people at Charles Schwab, they do better than the living, because their dead people have a tendency to be more patient and less emotional than living people. So,
well said.
It's a good idea to act like you're dead when you own Bitcoin. Travis, any other things you want to add before I say goodbye to you today?
No, that was a great conversation. I appreciate the time. Anthony, it was a pleasure. I'll see you in Jackson Hole.
Oh, good. We're excited to have you there. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm working on swag too, okay? So we'll have some Wyoming Blockchain Association swag for you when you arrive. Thank you so much for joining us today. Of course, you're here on the Wealthion Network. And as Travis said, that we're not here offering direct financial advice. But if you want that, you can go to Wealthion.com, and we have registered investment advisors on the platform that can fit your needs. And until next time, this is Anthony Scaramucci for Speak Up.